Clarence Harding, January 21st, 1970.
Down, and I'm nearly 75.
Yeah.
And
so you were born on God's Island.
On God's Island.
Yeah.
I had a few lobster traps when I was so small that my father would go with me to see that I pulled them over the side of the flat bottom boat. And when he okayed it and said that I could do it alone, I was quite proud, and I probably was 10 or 11 years old.
Yeah.
So I recall that I had 20 traps out this school season, and we had a man teacher for a change,
mm-hmm.
and he was an elderly man, and he'd taught at different times. And evidently, he'd met up with some tough kids in his career,
yeah.
Because I remember he saying to me, if all my kids had gone out and pulled 20 traps before school in the morning, they'd worked off some of the surplus energy.
Yeah. Well, were there a lot of people, people your age, going to see you that early when they were...
Goss Island was just a small community. There was only about 60 inhabitants in all, and probably a half a dozen of us boys about my age. And we all had a few traps out. Some of them had to have them out to earn money for their own clothes, but my money that I earned was mine.
Yeah.
And... I don't recall what I ever did with it. I guess never earned enough to worry about it.
Did you save up for a boat?
I suppose I must have, because my smallest one, the one that I told you was just a large row peapod with an aux motor put in it.
Yeah, 18 that, feet or so.
Yes, my father gave me that.
Yeah.
When he had a large boat built, and I think perhaps I used that, might have used that two summers.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 18, I had my first one built on my own, and I'd earned the money.
Who built your first boat?
Well, the first one was built by a man named Sargent, and he lived down on Sutton Island. It was a small a year-round colony down there at that time.
Yeah.
And I didn't like that boat. I only kept it about 2 years.
What was it like?
Well, it was the old steamboat stern.
Yeah.
The steamboat stern. It was 26 feet overall, which was a good size in those days. That was the average size. But as I told you yesterday, he supposed to have been a boat builder, but I never would call him a good one, because when he set the boat up in the beginning, he didn't properly see, that was the fantail. They had a long horn beam, they call it, see?
Yeah.
And it wasn't attached to the, it was just attached in one place to the stern post.
Hmm.
Right here on this inner end, and then it ran out probably 6 feet, and he didn't shore it up properly. In other words, he before the boat was only part built, that thing had started to droop. See,
because
he built that right into the boat, because it had drooped, and he didn't try to get it back in place again. And so when the boat was finished, it had that. It run downhill, I would call it.
Yeah,
And
sort of like a Leaning Tower of Pisa.
That's right. And a man that he wasn't a native on the island, but he married a woman that was a native, and I used to go around the boats would come out of water down there in what we call the pool,
mm-hmm.
and they were ground on the low tide, and I'd go around all the boats with my rule and I'd measure, because my boat, the new one, wasn't as high on the bow as I wanted to be.
Yeah.
So I would measure every other boat and just in hopes that I could make mine look higher.
Yeah.
And I never could.
Oh, dear.
And so I only kept it 2 years. But
did it perform badly too?
No, as I recall, it was a good able boat.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever bought it used it for it had a short life as boats go. It probably only had about half the life of an ordinary boat, but it was seaworthy.
Yeah.
And I think I can't quite remember, but I'll think about $150 or $200 for the woodwork, and I got a Hartford motor, they call them Hartfords in those days, a single cylinder for about $100, and
boy,
all the equipment, I suppose, was another, wasn't very much. I know you buy a compass, cost you $5, and all you had to have for a fire extinguisher was a bucket of sand. I don't know if you even had anything at first, but maybe. And then the next thing came out was a canister affair with, I don't know, I guess just flour in it. Oh yes, you could carry a bag of flour at one time for fire extinguisher.
Some certain kinds of fire, that wouldn't be too good.
No. And they've changed the fire equipment so many times. Now they did away with that pyrene stuff, and now we have the dry chemical. And but most hours, we don't have many fires. I don't think because we're too awful careful, but I think it's the type of the boat to get a good circulation of air. Because in the old days, everybody, when they in the window, when the water inlet would freeze up through the bottom, take a rag, wind it on a piece of wire, soak it in gasoline, light it, put it down in under on that fitting, and that would be right down in the bilge.
Yeah.
And no one ever blew up that I ever knew.
My word. Well, maybe they just had good pipes and tanks in those days.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Well, yeah. After that first boat, after you sold it, what did you do for a boat then?
Well, I always was, out of four-handed. There's only once that I got caught. I always had one on order when I sold the one before.
Yeah.
And
well, what was your second built boat?
The next one was the one that Merton Staples built over at Atlantic. He built over there then.
Yeah.
He's the man that told you what. Foreman for the Gamage yard.
Yeah.
And Mr. Gamage told him he wasn't his boss. And I got a chuckle out of that because I thought that was a pretty good pat on the back.
I'd say, yeah.
He didn't have to boss him.
He was a pretty good builder. Right?
Yes. He was a young builder at that time, but he'd worked with the islands in the days of sail. Every island or every fishing village, for that matter, always had builders. Some would only build for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Some would build one perhaps during the winter for a neighbor. But they all could turn out good work. I mean, that seemed to be part of their skill.
General know-how.
He worked. I guess he got his first training was working for one of those a lobster fisherman that built his own boat during the winter.
Yeah.
And built one more for, as I say, for a neighbor for a price, of course.
Yeah.
That boat I kept 15 years.
What was she like?
That was the 27. 27, that was the open boat in those days with the spray hood.
Yeah.
And 27 feet overall. And
was she decked aft?
No, the motor is in the center in that one. All my boats, the motor is in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And now my father's boat, the The motor was aft of the long deck.
Yeah.
But all mine, the motor was putting asunder.
Yeah.
And this one was the same, with just a shot the working deck aft.
Yeah.
And
how was she as a boat? Was she a
that was one of the best that I've ever been in. I've taken as rough water in that 27 as I have in any of the 33 and 34 foot boats. Mm. And
why do you think she'd do that?
I don't think you have to have a large boat. I've watched some of the fishermen in 28 and 30 foot boats, and they go out with a 34, 36 and 40 foot boats and stay in just as tough weather.
Yeah.
I think it's the the boats are they're all the same type, and just because one isn't quite as long doesn't make it any more risky to go.
Yeah,
isn't quite as handy maybe when you want to move lobster traps. You don't have the room to move as many at a time.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I think the smaller boats would, in some cases maybe they'd be, I'll say, even more seaworthy. Used for an expression, and I don't know anything about horses or anything like that, but they always, an expression was, we'll give a horse its head and let it pick its way, see?
Yeah.
And I don't think you want to fight a boat when it's rough weather, and it gets going fast on a sea that's carrying it fast.
Yeah.
Just don't push the power to it, but let the sea take it where it will, and when the sea's gone out from under,
yeah,
then bring it back to normal. But just,
yeah,
don't try to fight it right on top of a wave, because if you do, you might get it right broadside when the peak struck, you see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she was an open foot, a 27 foot open boat.
That was an open 27 foot boat with a spray hood.
Would she have a square stern?
Yes, it had the square stern. It was the same type that Merle Black told you that his father had. It was the, now the sterns of today are plumb.
Yeah.
The sterns of the boats that they built for a time were slanting,
yeah,
out, so they were longer on the water line than they were on top.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that was just, some man's opinion, I don't know what, because without any load in them, it made a longer boat on the water, and I guess somebody thought, well, it would go better, see?
Yeah, give him more chance,
yeah,
to get that run.
That's right.
Flattened,
mm-hmm,
out.
Yeah,
yeah.
But then that didn't last for very long, and,
mm-hmm,
and then they came to the, what they call them, the wood box stern, and that's what they've been ever since.
What they've been, yeah. Well, let's see, that was your third boat. When was that?
That boat was built in 1914,
mm-hmm,
and the next one, the one that Chester Clement built, was built in 1931.
Yeah. In
1931, in the fall of 1931.
Uh-huh.
And
was Chester working over at Southwest
Boat? Chester was working. That was his own. That was his own shop.
Yeah.
The main building is still there today. The old shop that he owned is the main part. You can tell by looking at it, it's the old part, see. And
Can you remember what you asked him for when you went to get that boat from him, or did you just take what he was building at that time?
For a model, I mean.
Yeah.
I took what he was building because he was good at it.
Yeah.
And all I told him was the size I wanted. Oh yes, I've skipped one between the 27 foot one. I thought that the years didn't fit in quite right. Between,
yeah,
the 27 foot one that was built in 1914 and the Chester Clement boat that was built in 1931, I had A boat built here in town that was 34 feet, 33 feet.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. And I kept it a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been, say, 1929.
Yeah.
About 1929, that would be right, 1929,
uh-huh.
The spring and summer of 1929, I was sailing a pleasure boat for a summer party, and I got a model. I never was, don't know why, I never could make a model of my own,
yeah.
But I'd try to tell the builder what I wanted, and in this case, I told the builder that I wanted a boat that wouldn't pound.
Yes.
I want it sharp, but I want it to come up as I like this, the sort of
yeah.
wedge shape, see?
Yeah, yeah.
And he got it too sharp. In other words, it didn't pound, but it didn't have any buoyancy.
Yeah, she drew too much.
Yes, and
who was the builder? Was he?
That was Cliff Rich up there, Bobby
Rich's
father.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And
so he didn't build on his standard model.
He took any model that you brought to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember going to the shop when the boat was partly completed, and I was working. I only had a little time at night.
Yeah.
And the boat was partly completed, and I said, I wish that I'd had that boat wider, Cliff. It doesn't look wide enough to me. Oh, he said, I can take care of that all right. I said, I'll spread it off on top.
Yeah.
Well, I was ignorant, and he wedged it apart on top, and where the model called for about 8 feet and 6 inches.
Yeah.
He wedged it off, let it spread off, so it was about 8 feet and 9 inches, and it went off 4 inches or such a matter.
Yeah.
But when they go off like that on top,
mm-hmm.
they take it away from down on the water. See?
Yeah.
In other words, I'd sacrificed. I'd got a boat like this because it's
sure,
taken me
flat.
It's taken the flat, taken the bearing away from it.
Oh dear.
And
yeah.
So, it was an awful tiresome boat to work in, and I guess I expected too much. Well, as I was telling, it might have been Ralph Stanley today,
yeah.
telling someone anyway, that we took the boat in at my dock down here to put the motor in it, and it was only a four-cylinder motor, not quite as large, of course, as they put in today, and not as heavy.
Yeah.
And that was a cabin boat. And with the motor in the cabin, where they all are today,
yeah.
that went down to the head. It was so sharp forward, in other words, it went down to the head so that the rudder came out of water.
Oh, my.
And after a year and a half that I used it, I had two bags of sand, this close-knit, like corn
yeah.
sacks, you know, the
yeah.
100-pound sacks, but they weren't too large around, I recall
mm-hmm.
it, but, and I had all I could handle in two of those sacks way back into the back end of the boat to hold it
yeah.
on an even keel.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't a good model.
Yeah, yeah.
But Malcolm yeah. McDuffie since then, when Cliff was still in his right mind, he said, do you think that hurt your business when Clarence sort of condemned that boat and sold it because of the faults? Cliff said, no. I'm glad he didn't hold it against me. He said, no. He said, that boat went up to Cape Pappas, and they used it for some years until it got ashore on a ledge and wrecked.
Yeah.
And he said, I had several orders come down from there for new boats.
Hmm. I'll be.
So they could see that the workmanship was all right. That was what they were going by. Just because the model was off, that was part of my fault and part of his.
Stock it up to experience.
Yeah, experience. Yep. That's right.
Well, what led you to go to
Clement? Well, now I'm down to Sim Davis.
Yeah.
I looked at his boat this afternoon. I hadn't been down there.
Isn't that something though?
I hadn't been down there since, it was just partly planked. And I said, do you remember, we're talking about boats. I said, who modeled this sim? Did they bring the plans down from New Jersey, or did you model it? Oh, this is my model. It's from one that I built for a sardine carrier.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, there's an awful lot of difference in powerboat models, isn't there? He agreed, and I was telling him of the different ones that I'd had, and one would roll, and they'd roll deep, but they'd roll easy, and one wouldn't roll very deep, but they'd stop quick, and sort of slat-like. And I said, do you remember I came to you to try to get you to build me a boat? And you were busy on something, and that's when he was a small builder, before he'd really get started. I guess I don't know where you had his shop, but he didn't have this one that he's in down there. That I do remember. He built up overhead in some building.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I advertised this boat that I didn't like in the through one of the brokers in Camden. And he sent the man to me. Now, the price of that boat was only a year and a half old. And a new Red Ring motor, $1,500 complete.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent a man to me from Cape Papas. The man had the money in cash in his pocket.
My.
And he came in December.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I can't part with the boat now. I'm going lobster now in winter, and I have to have something to go in. And he said, well, I was given to understand that I could have the boat if I liked it, and I like it, and here's the money. And I said, that we work out something. So we worked it out that I had the boat the 1st of April, and I took off $150, I think, off the price.
Yeah.
And so that left me, and my summer job started in June.
Yeah.
That left me the 1st of April, or the middle of April, till the 1st or middle of June, and I had to take an old 40-foot boat that I'd used for flounder dragging. That was an extra boat that I had just for winter fishing.
Yeah.
It was an old wreck that I patched up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a steamboat stern. In fact, it had a at one time when it was built, it was had a steam engine in it.
Mm-hmm. So she's pretty old then.
Yeah, that's right. And but well built, and I patched it up, and I put a and I had the I had a big old two cylinder motor and a sender, and I had on the a spare bilge engine to give it more power. I had a six-cylinder light marine. I think it was built around the Fordson Ford motor block on the side. Well, the old big clunk was too heavy to work around, and so I hoisted that out on the dock. I was a one-man operation anyway.
Yeah.
I hoisted that out on the dock, and I took the smaller one from over on the bills, and I jacked it up with pries and jacks and so forth, and slid it over onto the main beds, and lined it up with a shaft to float. And I used that for a lobster boat for about 6 weeks. And in those days, that was 42 overall, but not too wide. But they didn't go in lobster boats that size around here in those days.
Pretty big boat,
But I drifted around, and all the time I was looking for a builder.
Yeah.
And I went up to the Rich Brothers here at Duck Cove. Mm-hmm. And that's when I told you that the one that they let do the talking, he wasn't the carpenter by any means, but he was he did the painting and he did the talking, and he I suppose heard that I was in a bad way for a boat to start out my fall season after I got through with my summer party, so he jacked the price on me about $500.
Oh boy.
And I couldn't see it, so then I went to Sim Davis, and Sim was busy on something, and he couldn't build, and there didn't seem to be anyone around in this area that was building, and I was using Chester Clement's dock. My party was using his dock for a landing place, and we're getting the gasoline supplies there.
Yeah.
And this is midsummer, that time, mid-July, and he had this 80-some-foot rum run that he was already working on. He had a big crew trying to get that completed.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't suppose there's any use to talk to you about a 34-foot powerboat. And he took me by surprise. He said, I don't know, why not? And I said, well, you've got all you can work here. Well, he had a slow, moderate grin. He said, I have a space up at the head of the shop. And I said, I guess we can find a few carpenters to put onto it. And his price, now, he didn't take me over the barrel. His price was the standard price at that time. I think that was $1,000 for the hull.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, this chap up here, they thought they had me, and they wanted $1,400 or $1,500 for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
And that was I was very lucky in the workmanship in that boat. For the man that got out all the plank was an old one of the carpenter, he was mostly a house builder, mm-hmm. but he was one of the old time builders where everything went together that fitted. It didn't have to be planed whittled or anything. When they made the cut, they knew where they were cutting.
Yeah.
And he got every plank out, and he explained to me, he was nice that way, I was a young fellow. He explained how he got the plank, and he got the proper bevel so that when the two plank came together, as he said, they were solid wood to wood, and with the right amount of bevel to hold the cotton, but still the right amount of wood behind the cotton.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was right, because that boat is in existence today, and it must be, 31, 32 years old.
Hmm, yeah.
30, yeah.
Who owns it now?
Some of the people over at Sorrento.
Uh-huh.
I sold it, and I kept that 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I, the only reason that I sold it, in those days, we didn't have the watertight cockpit floor.
Yeah.
There was no boats. They didn't build them high enough, and so your floor, any water that came in your boat, you had to pump overboard, see?
Yeah.
And they were getting them higher sided and getting the scuppers through the side, and that's the reason that I got out from under it.
Uh-huh.
That's the only reason. It would have been good for, well, I've been satisfied with it as far as the everything else for another 10 years.
Yeah.
And I could have got by with it for 10 years
mm-hmm.
In my work without any trouble whatsoever.
So it was that watertight platform which...
any water that comes aboard these boats runs right out through the side of them. The only thing you have to be, if you take in a heavy load, we have scupper plugs to plug the hole.
Yeah.
Aside from that, anything that comes aboard, all the water that you wash up with and what comes in off the lobster traps, it goes right out through.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, let's see then. You sold her after 15 years. That would be about 1946.
That's right.
Yeah.
46, and that's just right, because I put in the order of Raymond Bunker and Ralph Ellis.
Yeah.
And I'd have these people that I'd sailed for, well, for 15 years. The first 2 years, they had their own yacht, and the Depression hit them, and they lost too much money, and so they sold the yacht, and they were sort of mourning. They didn't have a boat to get over to the cabin over at Goss, and
yeah.
I said, well, my boat is at that time was only about a year old, and I said, it's just a fish boat type, but I said, it's, and they liked the looks of it, and I, money, jobs wasn't too, summer jobs wasn't too plentiful. There's always somebody looking for a good job, and fishing, lobstering never was good in the summer, and so I made them a pretty good price, a pretty good offer, I think. I offered to go for the same as they were paying me, and put my boat in the deal.
Mm-hmm.
All they would have to do was allow me 3 days to paint it. They give me 3 days pay, extra pay,
uh-huh.
to put the paint on, and I figured, well, I might just as well be using it as to have it tied up on the mooring.
Sure.
And I didn't have the courage to go out and try to hunt up another job, because, I say, that boat never was all varnish, spick and span like the, you know, like the yacht type.
Yeah.
It was just an ordinary paint job, and so I didn't stand too good a show of competing with the fellows that were after the better job.
Well, except
and that boat, because I had several motors in it, but that boat, that Clement boat, the hull was $1,000. 15 years after, 1946, the hull of the one that I have now, 27 with extra woodwork that I had, like putting in the window back in the cabin, and putting trap sheathing on the side, and putting the labor putting copper ice sheathing on, and setting up my lobster hoist and all that sort of stuff, and the overall bill was $2,750.
Hmm.
And I was asking Raymond Bunker just a couple weeks ago, I said, what would that cost me today? Around $4,500. He said, near a five.
Yeah.
Near a 5,000.
Yes.
So, and from that, I got it just on the borderline from that year on, each year that they, well, they didn't build too many work boats, because they had a good hookup for yachts. They'd only build pleasure boats. They'd only build one or two a winter.
That's Raymond. And
that's Raymond, yeah. And but so happened the winter they built mine, they built four identical.
Uh-huh.
Mine's the first one, and there's three others identical, or some small changes, they didn't want them quite as high out of water as mine, and so they cut down in the height a couple inches, but aside from that, they used the same molds. And
they were watertight floors.
Yes, but they wanted the floors higher, and
mm-hmm.
I'd had one boat, that was on that one that was built at Sutton, and I didn't like it all, he didn't get the sides up high enough, and the floor came so high that my kneecap was right on the side of the combing, I had sore knees, so I, that's sort of every boat since then, I've always had it so that the kneecap goes in under the,
uh-huh.
under the combing,
Yeah, that makes good sense. Much sturdier that way. Huh. So you had it built sort of high for you.
Yes.
Yeah. Because you're fairly tall.
Mm-hmm. But it's gone down the water and it isn't noticeable now.
Uh-huh.
He told me when he first, he said, I was afraid it was going to look out of proportion, too high in the back compared to the bow, but he said it didn't, and it didn't, because it's gone down in the water, and after all, you carry quite a number of 100 pounds of bait and the anchors and all that sort of stuff. You carry that in the back end pretty much.
So he didn't carve a new model then, he just added a few strakes?
Well, no, I took the model that he'd been building pleasure boats off of.
Uh-huh.
I'd seen a pleasure boat that he built for a young fellow, a young summer fellow that I used to see over on the dock, and I liked the looks of it, and I said, well, build me one like that. So he took the, he'd save the molds from year to year, and so he had the same molds, and he made some changes, I guess, but he still had the, like Ralph Stanley. Now, Ralph, I don't know, about every winter he builds at least one, and most always he uses the same molds, but he varies in some way, like put them a little farther apart to make them longer, a boat longer, or blocks off to make them a little wider. But he, when they get one model, it works out pretty well. It's out of all boats that they build are sort of adapted from that.
You certainly can recognize these in the different men's boats.
Yes, they are. There's a little, there's just a little difference, enough so that you can see it, although sometimes boats will get shifted around. I have an idea that I know who built the boat, and I get fooled. But Bobby Rich is they're all practically the same.
Yeah. Well, now you were telling me down in the dock characteristics that you felt a boat ought to have. I wonder if you'd just reiterate. What the good qualities of a lobster boat should have, in your mind?
Well, they're all. I don't think there's any lobster boat on the coast anywhere today that doesn't have good qualities.
Yeah.
I don't think they they've been. Everything's been proved out, and any little flaw has been worked out of them, and it's just a matter of a man's opinion. Now, Jonesport have a faster boat than we have.
Mm-hmm.
Their boats are practically all a skig boat.
Yeah.
And that gives them a much flatter floor.
Mm-hmm.
Because all I got is a 4-inch or a 5 or whatever keel, just on edge like this, and knife-like.
See? It's all deadwood, though.
Yeah. Where a boat that's planked down has got that that amount of, I don't know what, displacement in there. That's what it is. It displaces the water, but it also, I suppose that's what it is. There's more displacement in the boat, makes them push harder.
Yeah.
And I don't doubt whether there's boats up here that will go just as fast. No, I guess not, because they always win all the races down in Jonesport.
They put
Cadillacs in them, and they load them with power.
Yeah.
But
and they build them lighter.
That's right. The majority of those boats are a little thinner plank, and the timbers are farther apart, and so forth and so on. But some harbors go all together for Jonesport. Dollar for dollar, I don't know what the difference in price would be, if any. Are they built cheaper or not? I never had an occasion to ask price.
How about running cost?
They're good sea boats. I never had any real experience with one, so So I don't know, but I have...
I was thinking cost in terms of what it costs to run one of those big...
Oh, I see. Well, it's like running... well, I don't know how to explain it, but you take... they all use automobile engines, and when you hit the throttle, no matter how easy the boat drives, it's going to cost you money.
Yeah.
They'll get there a little quicker, but they don't get there enough quicker to make up for the difference in the cost, either.
Yeah. I think that would hurt their income pretty bad.
Yes, well, that's all part of the overall. Now, I use a six-cylinder 135 in my boat, and I could put in, well, of course, the most of them now are 200s to 300, all depending on the motor that you buy, but I could get 2 miles an hour or more out of speed out of my boat, but it would cost me at least 10 gallons of gas per day more. To push the push it, see. So
it's quite a factor.
But some harbors they have a longer distance to go to get to the grounds. Now Stonington is one place where they go in for quite a lot of power in their boats.
Yeah.
And they have getting now quite a fleet of Jonesport boats up there. The newer boats are coming from Jonesport and Swan's Island has quite a fleet of Jonesport boats.
Mm-hmm.
But,
I noticed down here in Bath Harbor, there were just two Jonesporters in the harbor.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of about, what, 30 boats?
Yes, as many as that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they haven't really caught on here as much.
No, they've been satisfied with the, their type that they've used around here.
Mm-hmm.
And,
of course, they build their own here, too.
Yes. Now there's one boat here, it's hauled out now up here to Jimmy Rich's. That's Merton's boat. Merton was the builder, you know,
mm-hmm.
Of the two. The two brothers started the shop, and Merton was the builder, and he took his brother Jimmy in as a partner. And they built, I don't know how many boats, they built some fairly large ones that went to the west of this pleasure boat, so a commercial party fishing boats,
mm-hmm.
and but he's allergic to dust, any woodworking dust.
Yeah.
He had to get out of the shop. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And right now he has to take inoculations every two or three times a week. He's allergic anyway.
Yeah.
He built. Just before he turned the shop over to his brother, he built himself a lobster boat, and it's the, we'll say it's the largest one in the harbor. It's 36 overall and beamy.
Yeah.
And he put the V8 Palmer in it, 230 or 40 or 50 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
And he burns as high as 50 gallons of gasoline a day, and he does it day after day and day after day.
Oh.
I can go out, and I don't make quite as long days, but ones that do make a long day, as he does with 150 horse, will burn 20, 25 gallons. He'll burn from 35 to 50.
Oh, boy.
And so he's putting diesel. He's hauled out now for diesel power.
Yeah. That's really kind of too bad to see. Because speed is always expensive, no matter in what. In automobiles, boats, horses, a good many things. I was going to say women.
A boat's always a she, isn't it?
Yeah.
She's a she's a beauty or she's a bitch. Just do it to how you happen to feel about it.
Yeah. Or she's in the dry dock having her bottom painted.
Yeah, that's right. Having her bottom painted. And my boat, named for my wife Evelyn,
mm-hmm.
and I was telling this fellow that used to come here. Well, he moved back to town now, but he came from away originally, and. They want to know what kind of a day I had. And that was one of the winter days. And I said, it wasn't good at all. I said, I had to hang on with one hand and steer with the other when I was coming home. And I said, I talked to Evelyn and I told her she was trying to throw me overboard. You asked about that.
Yeah, yeah. You told me down there in the dock about possible origins for that, for those double-ended lobster boats.
Yes, well, I suppose in a way that they started from the, we'll say the Coast Guard surf boats were all double-ended, you know, the boats that they used with oars in the old days of the Coast Guard service, and a ship's lifeboat, or maybe a seine boat that they used for mackerel seiners in those days. And they just took that for a model and put the skig on, because they were, I don't know, I suppose there were some double-enders around here that were planked down, but a good part of them were built on a skig.
Originally,
yes, they didn't, well, I don't know what percentage they were. I suppose one time they might have been half that were the double-enders that we call them, but then when they started to get the wide stern, they found that they would carry so much better that they didn't last too long anyway, that double-ender. But I suppose that they're one of the best model, have to be, because that's the type they use over in the North Sea, you see. Well, they got nothing in the following sea. They got nothing to push them. A sea will split on the stern just as much as it would split on the bow.
Yeah.
And I suppose if they're built like any boat in the right proportion, the right beam, so that they don't capsize, I suppose they're probably the most seaworthy boat there is today.
Yeah. Were there sailing peapods when you were a boy?
Were there any?
Yeah.
For our tenders, boat tenders, about everybody used a peapod. Now, the one that I first lobster traps I pulled was just in a flat bottom punt. And then my father had a peapod built for me. And he didn't want me to upset it, so he had it built quite full, you know, not extra wide maybe, but quite full on either end.
Full into the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And I used to row around in that when I was going to grammar school and pulling my traps mornings.
How big a boat was that?
Well, like that'd be about 14 feet. That's about 14 feet overall. Yeah. We had rowlocks that came up above the rail.
Oh, yeah.
About this high, so that you stand and push this way, see, and you didn't have to stoop over.
Yeah. Regular thole pins, you had two pins?
No, we always used the rowlocks, but in this case, these were made so that it would slip down between the plank, the timbers, and then
the shear clamp,
and that made a strip between the timbers and the shear clamp. See?
Yeah.
And you'd have these rowlocks, wooden, of course, and they made so that it would just fit in between the timbers, which would be perhaps 6 or 8 inches apart, and it would come up here to the height you wanted, and then there was a double board probably at the top, or else it was a thick piece and thin down to go in, down into this shear strip.
Yeah.
But it was broad enough at the top so that you'd get a rowlock socket in the top of it, and then we'd use just the metal rowlocks.
I see. you get a socket on top and put your metal box in that.
That's right.
So it's sort of an extension of your gun.
Yeah, it's just an extension.
Yeah. Well, that first boat you had that had power was a Peapod, wasn't it?
That's right, but it my father had a top put on it.
Mm-hmm.
He had it, that was probably, that was an oversized one. I don't know what it was built oversized for, except that maybe I told you that in the days of the sailboats, when they would tow one of these larger peapods, and if it, if the wind, if they got becalmed, well, one man would get out in the peapod and he'd haul fat from that,
uh-huh.
as long as he didn't blow too hard. And
yeah.
then when it did, well, he'd come back aboard the sailboat and they would tow that peapod behind them.
Mm-hmm. Did those larger peapods they used like that ever have sails with them?
A spreet sail, something like
those
that.
Spreet sail,
just
yeah.
a spreet sail. Yeah.
Or just one? Or
yeah, just one.
Yeah, they never
just
carried
one.
Two or
no. I don't ever recall seeing them. Not except the these around here now that Hurricane Island outfit was there.
Yeah.
Or that rig. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
No, we only had just the one.
Well, let me ask you another thing. What were the small sailing boats that were in use here when you were young?
They're all Moss built. Practically
oh,
all.
Uh-huh.
Either Wilbur or Charles Moss. All that there again, these local builders. Now there was a builder, there was a lobster fisherman and a builder here in this town, and he built his own, and he'd build, one a winter or something like that for a neighbor. So they were, it was a mixture, but the majority of the boats, you could tell them as you can today, they had that Moss
mm-hmm.
line.
Yeah, sort of S. Here with
yeah.
the mm-hmm. and all. Yeah. So people went down to Friendship to get them then.
That's right. Yeah. My father had one, and of course he had sail all his life, but the last sail that he had was built by Charles Moss, and the harbor it got on, the inner harbor where the boats had to lay in rough weather. The tide left it completely on the low tide,
mm-hmm.
so there was probably six or eight or maybe even as many as 10 sailboats in there at one time, but they were all, 26, perhaps 28 feet overall would be the largest, but they were fairly shallow draft.
Uh-huh.
My father's was 26 and it was centerboard.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the few that Charles Moss built. Most of the Moss boats, they built deep enough so that they didn't use centerboard. They had part inside ballast, but they did have an iron keel to get the weight that they needed.
Yeah. Well, there was an older type, before the keel Friendship.
That Muscongus bay type, you mean?
Yeah. Which looked just the same, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Pretty much the same.
So perhaps his was just a Muscongus
bay loop. Yes. McLean, I think, built. Was mostly a difference in their shear. And now the Mosses, Charles and Wilbur, were brothers. I get this more from my brother, which is. He's 12 years older than I, and it seemed like there was a feud on between the two brothers, pretty much. One thought his was the best, design, and
mm-hmm.
I asked my brother, what was the difference? And he said, well, Wilbur Moss, he guessed probably built the most boats of the two, but he was the most, my brother would use the word domineering of the two.
Uh-huh.
He was one of these fellows, well, I guess I know,
uh-huh.
I'm just saying that. I guess I know and my way is the best and my boat's the best. And and I said, what was the difference? And he said, not too much. He said, Wilbur Moss's boats were what they call hollow-bowed. Charles Moss had his boats would be more full forward,
mm-hmm.
and Wilbur's would be inclined to be hollow, and then they'd come out to their bearing, see?
Yes.
And something to do with the shear, too, the top shear, that Wilbur's had a more of a crook up on the shear aft.
Uh-huh.
But little things like that, someone that was familiar with the tool could pick out, but anyone that didn't know would, you know, just say, well, that's a Morse boat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, sir. You like a boat that handles well running as well as going into the sea?
I don't think there's a boat in this harbor that I would be afraid to take out or go out with, and run them in the falling sea as hard as you want to run a boat. And that's and my experience there is, like I say with the horse,
mm-hmm.
Give them its head. Now, if you get going fast on the sea, I've heard fellas say, oh, I like to look out over. I like to have the boat run so I can look out over this way and see it hanging.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing doing. I'm an old man, but I never play that kind of a game.
Yeah.
When the boat gets traveling too fast, I take a little power away.
Yeah.
And I let it pull back.
Is it at all dangerous to have a sea behind you like that and get yourself canted down?
Yeah, it could be.
Uh-huh.
It could be.
So
there's never. Well, I can't recall anyone ever getting capsized. I recall one Jones footboat getting capsized on a tow line. They got disabled in the wintertime, and they on a tow line and the following sea, and it rolled over on them.
Yeah, and, of course, the tow line tend to drag around,
that's right,
wouldn't it?
That's right, yeah. It had to go pretty much the way the tow line was dragging it. It just took away that right that it had to
keep its own head.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she broke then.
Yeah. Rude. No, we there hasn't been too many fishermen lost. After all, when you think of the chances, we don't realize the chances we take, but we do. On these gasoline motors, you're hauling right in around a rough shore, the wind's blowing on, and just one little wire drop off your ignition somewhere, or take the time to smut the points, it would be just too bad. So, something seems to look after us, I guess.
Yeah, I see.
No use to worry about those things. But after all, that's and of course, if there was a big casualty list, anything like the automobile casualties, why, people would worry, so they probably probably wouldn't go out on just the choice day.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We don't have that.
Well, you've had pretty good life loss, haven't you?
Yeah. It's lobstering is a one-man job. You never get rich at it. I'll tell you that right now. The ones that got rich at it have had some other way of getting rich.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't did it all this way.
Yeah.
But you have a good free life, and I guess it's a healthy life because we're something like MacArthur's soldiers. We just fade away. That's
uh-huh.
all. We just
uh-huh.
simply slow down until. That's it.
Yeah. There are a good many men around the harbor here now who've been lobstermen for as much as 50 years.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a healthy profession. I wish, in a sense, that I could be
involved
in all
it's odd. Now, of course, my father lobstered a fish to one or both all his life, and that's all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
I did take time out, and I went to Shaw's Business School in Portland. I found there's nothing in that set of books that I
mm-hmm.
cared about going into for doing my living.
Yeah.
But I had, my wife and I had the twin sons, and we wanted them to have a better life.
Yeah.
So we saw that they got through the university, and Dave, one of the twins, is in the Fred Lynham Company over in Bar Harbor,
mm-hmm.
his senior partner. And the other one, he had what I thought was the best, I thought he'd picked the best course in college. He picked mechanical engineering,
mm-hmm.
and they went right from the college into the service of mm-hmm. Second World War, and they both went in as, you know, officers because they had the ROCT training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the mechanical engineer was put into the automatic and put into heavy artillery, and he got he didn't get out of this country during the war, 2 years and a half, but he was sent to some sort of school about all the time he was in service. It was a gunnery school and radar school, and he had the radar maintenance group under him, and he was interviewed by different concerns after while he was still in the service, and he chose the General Electric, and he worked 1 year in Lynn for General Electric, 1 year in Pittsfield, and he threw it up and come back 22 years ago to catch lobsters.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Less money, but just a free life.
Yeah, yeah. What does a daily schedule go like?
A daily schedule goes from as early in the morning as you can see till as late at night as you can see,
uh-huh.
when there's anything to go for.
Uh-huh.
When there's when the season is off, man slows down. When the season is good, he has to push it because it's so much bad weather.
Yeah.
You can't now. I fish a reasonable amount of bad weather. Some say I fish tougher days than I should, but there's others that do the same too. But if you get, let's see now. I made a 9 month year this year. If you get 170 to 80 days out of the 9 months, that's days, full days on the water.
Yeah.
That's good average.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the time isn't your own because you have all this equipment on the wharf to keep
mm-hmm.
in order. You have your boat keep in order. The days that you're not going out, there's always something that's requiring
yeah.
work. So
yeah.
we put in lots of hours, but it's your own time. You can do it or not, just you like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I suppose it catches up with you, though, if you haven't been doing your work.
The only
shore work.
The young electric light man here this morning, he said, you're not lobstering this winter? And I said, no. It's the third winter now that I've stayed ashore.
Mm-hmm.
I went till I was 72.
Mm-hmm.
I went every winter, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you don't miss it, do you? And I said, yes, I do. I turn my shortwave on and I listen. Dave,
mm-hmm.
the other boats are out there and think, well, now I'd ought to be out there, too.
Yeah.
And I think, well, how lucky it is I don't have to be out there.
Yeah,
and I said it's a free life, and I guess that's why no one likes it. And but I said, you've got to, if you take too much time off, you don't get anywhere. And I said, now there's one man, he died at the age of 50, but and apparently, I thought he was a well man, but he died of a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And they performed an autopsy, and they said that his body was every part of his body was the age of away in the 70s. In other words, he'd sort of dissipated his life away.
Yeah.
He'd played around. and drank too much. And but I mentioned the fact that my wife and daughter-in-law met him. This had happened quite a good few years ago now. But they met him coming out of the drugstore, and he was going in and had a beautiful fall morning, and he couldn't find a better day.
Yeah.
And the lobsters were—it's a good season at that time. See?
Mm-hmm.
And he made an excuse to them. He knew that all the other boats were out of the harbor. Mm-hmm. He says, "Well, you know, I'm taking the day off. I'm taking it easy." He says, "My traps are out there earning me money." And I explained to this young fellow, I said, "Yes." When he went out to haul the next day, he found the money in the traps. But if he'd gone the day before, he found the money too. In other words, he just lost one day.
That's right.
And I said, he died. He didn't have anything. He had bills left for his widow to take care of because he lived that kind of a life, and still it didn't make a long life for him because he sort of burned the candle at both ends.
Yeah, yeah.
And the young fellow said, "Well, you know, I'm from Bar Harbor." And he said, I run a string of beaver traps. And he said, "There's two other fellows over there, and they tend the traps every weekend." And he said, "I go out the night with a flashlight, and I tend mine three or four times a week."
Mm-hmm.
He said, one of the fellows has got more traps out than I have. He says, he's caught three beaver this winter. He's caught four beaver, and the other boy's caught three beaver. He said, I've caught 11.
Oh, oh.
And he says, one trap has caught me four beaver.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if I only tend it once a week, I wouldn't get the four beaver out of that
right,
trap.
That's right. You'd be one in there filling it up for the week.
Yeah.
Well, it's industry that pays, I say. Well, in the morning, I've never been lobster. Never been out with a man, but like when you get out in the morning, I suppose you have to get the bait ready.
You do all that the night before.
Do that.
We're all ready. Even if we work way after dark, we have everything prepared for the next morning when we start out.
Uh-huh. Perhaps you could tell me how that goes.
Well, we use, in this harbor, right around in this section, we use the cuttings, we call it, from the sardine, the herring, say, the refuse from the sardine.
For chum? Is that what you
call it? No, we don't use chum. That doesn't, well, let me see now. They don't make chum anymore, I'm trying to think. They cut the fish now, cut them raw.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Underwood, who's back here in McKinley, I guess still make chum.
Yeah.
But we never did care too much for that since the old days when Underwood fried their fish in, what kind of oil was it?
Soybean oil?
No, that's what they use now. And the herring, the lobsters don't like it. Would it be cottonseed? I was going to say linseed, but
it didn't
be cotton. No, it'd be, anyway.
Cottonseed or.
And then the soybean came, and that makes it sort of a blubbery. It doesn't apparently have the tolling qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And. The lobsters never liked it so well. And now, this new management, they cut the fish now, pretty much. So it's just a matter of junks of herring or whole herring. And herring again is scarce on the coast now that you hardly ever buy a whole one anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And other harbors, they use fish gallons altogether when they're near a fish processing plant. They use the racks, they call them.
The racks.
String those on.
Yeah, on the head.
It's all just a matter of. Now, I was in Nova Scotia for a couple of days this early summer, and I talked to the lobster dealer at Digby, and he wanted to know what we used for bait, and I told him, and he says, "Well, you know, it's odd, but he says there's three sections right around this area, not too far apart." And he says, one section, he says, right here, they want herring.
Yeah.
And he said, not too far away, they want mackerel. And he said, just beyond that, they want Flounder. Well, that's the best bait.
Yeah.
And I said, well, in the days, our flounders have gone here mm-hmm. completely.
Yes. I remember catching them when I was a boy, but you can't find one now.
But down there, he said, oh, you just drag in around the harbor here. Of course, in the days around here, we used to spear them, go in the cove anyway and spear them in them.
Yeah.
So they've gone completely.
Nothing much help.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so in the morning, you go right down and get right on your boat and go right on out to your traps.
Yes, plan on when the days, of course, in June or July, when the days are long, you don't go out before the sun gets up. But any time when the fishing is good, like, there's a season starts about perhaps the 1st of April or the 1st of June. It's a good spring fishing.
Yeah.
Middle of April to the 1st of June. And then it dwindles down to poor summer fishing, and then after the new shells come out in August or whenever, it picks up to a good fall fishing. The fall's the best of all.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the days are starting to even shorten them, and everybody's out just as soon as they can see the lobster boy.
Mm-hmm.
That means we leave before dark.
Yeah.
While it's still dark.
While it's still dark, before light.
Yeah, before it's light.
Where were your fishing grounds?
Well, I go out in the area out beyond Gotts and Black
mm-hmm.
and out through between Long Island and Duck Island off mm-hmm. when I go into the deep water off toward Mount Desert Rock, about halfway
uh-huh.
to Mount Desert Rock.
That's in the wintertime?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Of course, in there, when the lobster are on the shore, you have your choice. You can put them any way you want. There's always been a little feud, not too much, not too bad in this section, but in some places they think, well, you're supposed to stay, they call it in your own territory, not going somebody else's territory, but
uh-huh.
that, your license, you buy a license and it doesn't tell you what territory to go in.
Uh-huh.
So you go where you want.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes there'll be a hothead that'll start a war, as we call it, by cutting a man's rope and tying great long horse knots, we call it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but it's
is there any
pretty good bunches of them.
And the Long Islanders tend to be that way?
Long Island's a good bunch of fishermen. I don't fish near them,
uh-huh.
but I never heard any complaint. So I would say that they're as good a bunch of fishermen as you'll find anywhere around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember hearing about some time back a real war. Something. This came down in East of my father. I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There has been wars. There has been trap wars on, and when I was a boy, now my father was a great bird hunter, seabird, and that's when before so many gasoline engines scared the birds way off,
mm-hmm.
so and they, you know, coming around the shores and. And certain, they go gunning for them with a decoy.
Yeah.
And I recall that that was about the time that, I don't know, I probably was 15 or 16 years of age. And he took me with him. There was four in the party, I think. We went to Isle of Hoe. And that was always a good spot for birds flying by, you know,
mm-hmm.
and being an outside island.
Yeah.
And he and his cousins, man, the same age, they went ashore to visit. That was in the Head Harbor on the south end of the island. They went ashore and they visited this old man. His name was Grant. And I was, and this grant, they said to charter man, they had, it was a war some years before that, and he shot a fisherman, killed him. And I was an impressionable age, of course. And I can see the old man sitting there now in the kitchen, huddled around the fire, and he was, oh, I don't know, probably might have been even 80 years old, but he had this gray beard, and all you could see was his eyes, you know, showing out. And I kept thinking they were talking to him because they'd known him from other times that they'd been up. It seemed like people knew more people then than they do now. Now they're too busy to get acquainted.
Yeah.
And but I kept eyeing him up and thinking, well, would he do a thing like that? Would he deliberately shoot a man? He claimed he was poaching, you know, and all this. But they're trying to drive him away anyway. He's an outsider.
Yeah, it's funny memories of a fellow named, I think his name was Butler, lived up there in Indian Point and had been convicted of killing somebody with an axe, I guess, and been paroled out of prison. He was living there in his house up there next to Vernon, like my uncle, and, up there almost on the way the road goes by Clark Cove up there. I don't remember, but I remember being afraid to walk by his house. Anyway. Well, if you go out early in the morning like that, how long would it be before you finish up your trap?
You put in the good fishing. Some of the men, some of the tough fellows, they must put in as many as 14 actual hours of working on the boat, and then they have to take the bait aboard. Take care of the lobsters when they get in, take the bait on board before they go home. So they're putting in 16 hours of real...
They will say 6 o'clock to... If they came back at 6 o'clock at night, they left 6 in the morning and came back 6 o'clock at night.
Yes.
Then where would they go, right? To the lobster dealers and car up there. And then get there, and then they go over to Underwood and get their bait.
Now the dealers get the bait for them. The dealers have it come with a truckload and put it right in the bait shed. So they're giving the bait. He's only just dipping it up in dishes and putting it on board. It makes it a little bit easier that way.
You carry a tub right on board?
Yeah.
Do you put it in, I'm just wondering, you know, I've seen these little bait bags.
Yeah.
Do you bag it up?
Yeah. That's the way they speed things up now. Some hire boys to fill up the bait bags while they're out. They have an extra set of bait bags, and the boys after school or during the summer when they're not in school, they fill up a whole day's supply so that the man on his lobster, he just reaches down into his dish and picks up a bag, and he doesn't have to bother to... stuff them as he goes along.
Yeah. Does that tied inside the trap, or is it just dumped in?
It's tied. It's in the bag and a pucker string.
Yeah.
It puckers it up, and then they tie it around the around the guy line.
Yeah.
A little kid.
Great cat. Yeah. He's very interested about this.
He's curious. He's very curious.
It's a great cat. Yeah. I think he's a lovely thing. So that's a long day's work, isn't it?
My day generally runs, I'll say 10 hours. It isn't a day that it would be less than 10 hours. Sometimes I put in 12-hour day, but as I say, the real drivers, the young-blooded fellows, they put in a much longer day, much longer.
In the winter time, do you spend a lot of time building new traps?
Well, we build our own, so it takes quite a lot of time to build one up, and it all depends on how the storms use you and how many you put in the water. Now my son is building. He built 100 last winter, and he's building 100 this winter. Some of the fellows probably build even 150. And they just do it days when they're ashore. There's quite a lot of days in the wintertime that you're ashore, too. But some Some hire somebody to build them, hire somebody to knit the heads. But there again, it's just the man. If he wants to have more free time when he's ashore, he hires it done, takes it out on his income tax. And a man that doesn't want to force it too hard on the water will force it a little harder in the winter and save a few dollars that way. It's just the man himself, how he feels.
Well, I noticed in the wintertime a lot of men go out in pairs in one boat.
Well, we don't in this harbor. That's odd too. But most every harbor on the coast, I'll say, they carry. That's an expression I never heard until some time ago. A stern man.
A stern man.
Yeah, that's what they call a stern man. The one that handles the second man. Well, I've always heard it called the second man, but this lobster buyer up in Booth Bay Harbor came to call on me last spring, and I hadn't seen him for about 20 years. He used to have my cod lobsters, and then he sort of broke away, and he came back and was talking to him, and he wanted to know if I carried a stern man, and I couldn't think what he meant. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, up home, he says, they all carry a stern man, and then I tumbled what he meant. I said, no, we're still going single here.
Yeah.
And he said, well, they have a system up there. They have 600 traps, and they put them two on a warp. And they haul half of them each day. That means 300. 300, but that's 150 buoys that they pick up. And the stern man, he says, they handle them so much faster. He says they're through the day by 2 o'clock, and then they take off and enjoy themselves for the rest of the day. And I said, well, that's a good idea, but I never got to it. And I said, I'm too old to start now. But as a general rule, a fisherman is so independent that if he you've got to make it worth a man's while to go with you, of course. And if you pay for the day and then you don't get out while the man's pay is going on, if you pay on a share basis, why, that's really the only way the guest to do it, and then the man has some incentive to be around. But otherwise, you say, well, I'm going to leave the harbor at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning, and 5 o'clock comes, your man doesn't show up, and you don't know if he's going to come at all. And maybe he's overslept, or maybe he was out late last night and hasn't got home yet.
Can't find his way down to the wharf. You got to be some. There's got to be an incentive way to it. I'm sure. Well, what was I going to ask you? Oh, do they ever use the term coolie around?
Coolie?
Yeah.
Like you mean the Chinese coolie?
Yeah.
What would they use that word?
I heard that. Heard the idea of a lobsterman having using the term coolie for, I guess, the boys who fill up his bait bag and this kind of thing.
I never heard that word around here.
I heard this from somebody who wasn't a lobsterman.
It hasn't been too many years that anybody has even hired the bait bag filled. I'll say, right around this area, it's just the young fellows have come in the last few years, and they've sort of brought a lot of new ideas with them. The banks have been very liberal with their loans, and of course the dealers, to a certain extent, are liberal, because the more lobsters they buy, the bigger their profit is at 10 cents a pound. That's about what their turnover is. And if they've got extra dollars, well, they'll fit out a fisherman. Partly fit him out anyway, but the banks, as I say, have been very liberal. And a young fellow comes in, and I Dahl borrowed money, and he gambled. He gambled with the other fellow's money, and he doesn't even build his own lobster traps in the winter. He hires it built because it's just a question of money, and they're doing all right at it.
Yeah, they're lucky.
But they haven't gone through the hard years that I've gone through.
Yeah.
And I hope they never do, because if they do, I unless they've paid up some of their debts, they're going to be looking for a stern man job.
Yeah, yeah. They're going out for wages.
Yeah, because they put in diesel motors, they have the snowmobiles, they have whatever's going, and they don't own it.
Yeah.
But they're making the payments on it. In the case of their, we'll say, in the case of their house insurance and their car insurance, they pay in installments. And I heard my son, of course, is in that business, and
yeah.
He laughed and he said, "I went to this house and the woman said, you're handing me us another policy," and I says, "I'm just making the last payment on last year."
Oh.
Last year's policy. He said, I told her that probably things would tightening up. It might be a different from now on. And he says, it's got to be. He says, he says, they're cutting us down, the big companies, they're cutting us down on our premiums.
Yeah.
So that... if we carry big accounts or a lot of small ones, and we need money, we go to the bank and we hire money for, and have to pay on a short term, I think he said 9%, and he said, we're only getting 8% from our deal.
Mm-hmm.
He says, it's no use to run a business that way.
No.
So, so he says that most of the companies now working out where they're going to charge interest on, on overdue accounts.
Uh-huh.
They give you, well, I don't know what, I'd say 30 days, I'm just using that for a figure, but they give you so long a time after that, it'll be an interest charge added on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Carrier
yeah.
charge.
Yeah. Looks like somebody hooks rugs.
End of interview with Clarence Harding.